Good afternoon. If you are looking for the session on the gift economy, a woman-based economy, economics, and cultural perspectives for peace, you're in the right room. If you're looking for sex education, it's down the hall. I'm Hina Pendel, and I'm one of the facilitators that is hosting you. And in the back is another co-facilitator, Kimberly. So we're just like orchestra leaders. We're going to set the context and help start the session and introduce you to each of the presenters. And we are going to try to find cards for you to write on so that if you a question pops into your head during one of the presentations, that you write it down, and then we'll come around and we'll collect them so that we'll have a question and answer time. Now, you know that this session extends over two time periods, and all the presenters have agreed to stay over the break. So if the questions keep going and the discussion wants to keep happening, it will go through the break. So you're welcome to stay through that time. The way we've set it up, or they've set it up, is that we're splitting it into four presenters for this first time period and four presenters for the next time period, okay? And we'll have questions after the four presenters, so we're not going to interrupt any of the presenters for that. Does that sound okay to everybody? So that's the flow. Now I want to ask you if you have a cell phone or anything that makes noise in your pocket or your purse, shut it off. Turn it off. If you have something that vibrates and it makes you jump out of your seat, shut that off too. Okay. When you're writing your questions, I would like to ask you to make those questions short and concise. When we collect the questions from you, we're going to sort through them. Often what happens is that several people ask similar questions. So if we ask a question that's thematically the same as yours, it may not come out sounding word for word because we may cluster some of those questions together. Okay? And if you feel like you haven't been heard, then talk to me. I want to set the tone that for us to remember that there's a lot of wisdom in the room. There's wisdom making presentations, and there's the wisdom that each and every one of you bring to the room. And I want to say that there are no wrong questions. There are no wrong answers. We're here to listen with curiosity and to bring ourselves to the present and to listen with as much capacity as we know how to receive people. Everyone will have an opportunity to have their question answered, and we want to include all of the wisdom that sits in this room. So that's kind of like the agreements, and my partner over there, Kimberly, is putting the agreements on the wall. Great. So are there any questions about the format or how we're doing? There's also a young lady here who's going to be a timekeeper, and she's going to alert. So if you see somebody jumping up and down or holding cards up, it's her job. Yes. Great. Okay. So first up, remind me your name. Are you?
Genevieve.
You're Genevieve Vaughn. Okay. Genevieve is an independent researcher working on a paradigm-based theory of the gift economy. She started the Foundation for a Compassionate Society, which is a multicultural all-women activist foundation for social change. She is the author of for giving, a feminist criticism of exchange, and is from the United States and Italy. So, Genevieve, thank you for joining us. It's a joy to have you.
Thanks a lot.
Let's welcome.
Thank you. Throughout the conference, we've been talking about a lot of different things and a lot of very difficult questions. I believe that if we could take a totally different perspective, the questions would change and we'd be able to make peace more easily. So this panel is trying to provide a deep alternative perspective. I'll tell my story first about who I am and how I got into this. And then a number of other women from other cultures will talk about their perspective, which is pertinent to this one. Also, there's literature over there if you want. There's books. I have some more books, which I'll bring later. I just didn't get them here in time. But you're welcome to have the books and all the literature that's there. When I was I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas. So I'm a hometown girl here, almost. I went to school at Hockaday in Dallas. I'm basically a Texan who has taken a really long journey elsewhere. when I was a young girl, and I was had a well-to-do family, and I was always wondering why some people had a lot of money and other people didn't have any. And I asked the question a number of times, and some people said, well, poor people are just lazy, or they're unlucky, or, the environment just isn't good in their country, or that kind of thing. And then I met and later married an Italian philosopher, and I asked him the question, why are some people rich and other people poor? And he said, it's because there's a transfer of wealth going on between the poor people and the rich people. And that really convinced me at the time. And as I said, I married him and had three daughters with him, and then got a divorce and did other things after that. But... But he was Italian, and I moved to Italy, first in Milan and then in Rome. And about the first year we were married, he was invited to a meeting in Bologna of professors who wanted to do a new journal. And the journal was to be on Marx's analysis of the commodity and money as applied to language. And it may sound like a strange idea, but I was totally fascinated by it. In fact, I had at this meeting this aha moment in which I felt like I could understand everything, and I had to go lie down in the other room because I was so overwhelmed by it. And in fact, I've been working on this ever since, and it's been now 40 years, more. And I've been on a fantastic intellectual journey doing this. So, however, he began his work by applying the exchange and the market, those concepts, to language and looking at language as an exchange. And I was not convinced about what his approach was, because I began having little children, and the children could speak, but they couldn't exchange yet. They didn't know how to use money. So I figured language could not be based on exchange. And I wondered why was it so similar, though? And how could I explain it? And I wrote some papers back then. And then I began thinking of indigenous cultures, which are not based on markets, and where people certainly speak. And I thought, maybe the language doesn't come from the market, but it comes from gift giving. That is, the kind of circulation of gifts that there are in indigenous economies. And then I went another step forward, and I became a feminist. I began to hear about how much women's work was unpaid, and how housework would add 40% to the GNP if it were calculated in monetary terms. And I was looking at this huge gift, and looking as if women were giving a huge gift to the economy of the market. So I began to think of language in terms of gift giving and mothering rather than exchange and the market. And that gave me a whole new theory of language that I continue to try to develop now, which is language as a virtual gift-giving system where words are gifts and we satisfy each other's communicative needs with verbal gifts. Now, the important aspect of that for a feminist conference is to think that instead of having language based on our understanding of language, or the language faculty, let us say, the ability to speak, as based on abstraction and what they call phallogocentrism, that is, it's not a patriarchal scheme of language, but a scheme of language based on gift-giving and mothering rather than on abstract terms and exchange. So it gives back to women and mothers the faculty of language. Well, then I began to look at the gift economy as pre-capitalistic economy, as a women's economy that is still now in our society, as it was in non-capitalistic societies, that underlies the society and that the economy of exchange in the market depends on. There are two different logics, the logic of gift giving and the logic of exchange. The logic of gift giving is transitive. It takes a product which it gives to another person and satisfies a need. So it's other-oriented. The logic of exchange is ego-oriented. It gives to the other person in order to get your own needs satisfied. And it is it requires measurement and quantification and an equation of value between one product and the other. So they're two different, very different logics. And the gift logic is what happens in mothering, where we satisfy needs of children directly because children can't give us back an equivalent of what we've given them, certainly not on the moment, and maybe never. In gift economies, of which there are still those existing, and mainly in matriarchies, and we'll hear more later about matriarchies with Heide Gottner Abendroth's work. There are many of those still existing. We don't have to have the market in order to survive. We could create an economy outside the market. And in fact, people are even trying that now in many different ways. you'll see, for example, the free software movement online. You see people doing free cycling or alternative communities that try to do things on the basis of the gift economy. There's Wikipedia. It's really interesting how liberating gift giving is and how good for the soul, because exchange creates adversarial relationships. Each person is trying to get more than the other person out of the exchange. And gift giving creates mutuality and trust, especially when it is done in an egalitarian way, because it can be misused as well. It can, if it's put into a hierarchy, the people below have to give to the people above. And we want to try to avoid that in any society that we want to plan anew, so that we don't recreate the same problems that we've had all along. I think one of the reasons why we have patriarchy and exchange that have kind of merged is that we are creating a situation in which boys are taught that they're not supposed to be like their mothers, they're not supposed to be nurturing, and so they have to create an alternative identity that doesn't really satisfy anyone. When they're little, all children identify with their mothers who are nurturing them, and they are existing in a gift economy of giving and receiving with their mothers. Little boys learn that they're in a gender that's opposite that, in a different category. And so what can they be? Actually, all of us are givers and receivers. So they take on another kind of identity, perhaps imitating a father who is far off and who had that same situation himself when he was a little boy. And so they become more abstract and hit instead of giving, because hitting creates a relationship with another person. It touches the other person, but it's a relationship of hierarchy instead of mutuality and trust. Well, I see I already don't have as much time as I need here, but I wanted to just introduce this idea, and then other people will pick it up and tell you more about it, what it's like in practice. I think this process that I'm talking about, I call that masculation, where boys are taken away from the model of the nurturing mother and alienated from that model, which is really, I think, the basic human model. And that is the basis of patriarchy in my idea. So we have what I call patriarchal capitalism, where the market, which is not nurturing because it requires that equal give in order to receive, and cancels a gift. It doesn't have a nurturing logic, and it is invested with the motivations of domination and competition that are typical of patriarchy. So we have patriarchal capitalism. Outside of patriarchal capitalism, we have people behaving according to the gift logic a lot of the time without ever recognizing it. And I believe that the gift, this gift logic, is a key to so much of what is in the academic world and is still not understood, because we've got a blind spot that is looking at gift giving and receiving and needs. We put down gift giving as something unimportant because we don't pay for it. It's outside. It's not worth it. If it's not named with money, it's not worth anything. And this is ruining our society. We are turning ourselves into abstract machines, creatures who are unhappy within and are creating devastation without. And not only our individual selves, but our country is working this way. So we really need to shift back onto this gift economy, recognize it in what we're doing, and bring it forward in a paradigm shift in order to see how we can get out of this situation. I just wanted to mention that I believe that war is based on exchange, on vengeance, on hitting and being hit back and trying to hit harder. So we have the September 11th, we were hit, and now the war took place because we had to pay back the people that did it to us, and we still haven't found them. We're paying them and paying and paying, making them pay. So there's this whole metaphor of the market is part of war, and we need to step out of that. The same thing, we need to step out of the justice as payment for crime and have restorative justice and justice as forgiveness and solving the need that gave rise to the crimes in the first place. We need a society that looks at needs, not only at profit or not at profit. Okay, so this is the beginning of thinking about the gift economy. Now I'm going to turn it over to Bernadette Muthian from South Africa, who will tell us in her voice about her own people and how the gift practices they have. And then we will also have people talking about activism and what activism is, a gift to change society, satisfying the needs for social change. So here we are.
Thank you very much. Okay. I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name, Bernadette Muthian. All right. Bernadette Muthian is an independent scholar, activist, working in the areas of human rights, conflict resolution, gender and gender-based violence, sexuality, and HIV/AIDS. She is the co-founder of Engender, a nonprofit organization providing research and capacity building for communities on human rights, justice, and peace. She's from South Africa. So welcome, Bernadette. Thank you. And pass your cards this way and raise your hand if you want another card.
Thank you. I would have had a photograph up of where I'm from, which is the continent of Africa and the southernmost tip of Africa. I was born there. Some people are wondering why I look the way I look and why in Northern California, when I was studying there and living there, people were speaking Spanish to me. My father was born in India, and my mother is half Dutch, which is one of the last set of European colonizers of my country. And my mother is First Nations, First People, the first people arguably in Africa called by Europeans the Bushman, and by us the Khoisan collectively. So I trace, like many before me, generations before me, my ancestry through my mother line. And hence, I identify with my African roots and with my mother being Khoisan. Now, some people are trained, and we have been trained in the same way, to think that the people who live in the place they come from, the people who have been colonized, may not necessarily have the knowledge. I was in Bamako in Mali at the African Social Forum at the very generous invitation of Genevieve Vaughan. This dress, in fact, was gifted to me by a Malian woman, an Malian activist, a beautiful souled woman who practices the gift economy. So in fact, when I am in Mali, I don't think that what we are practicing, which is matrilineality, matrilocality, gender egalitarianism, whatever terms we want to use in English or in other languages, be it Spanish, English, Portuguese, German, whatever, that these come from elsewhere. I just live these principles because they are intrinsic to who I am, where I come from, and we have always practiced these things for centuries and generations. If we look at Einstein's popular equation, E equals mc squared, it postulates that energy, which is the thing some of us can feel and see and that we play with from time to time when we're in a good mood, and matter, which is like my cellulite, they're not only related, they're also different forms of the same thing. So people can actually walk through walls. We've heard of Native Americans shape-shifting, which some people call awfully exotic. David Bohm had added a third element, which he called, meaning, or what we call consciousness, which implies that the, you know, there are three things, the energy, the matter, my cellulite, and consciousness, the way in which I can make energy or matter behave as I choose to, blah, blah. We have always known this, and we have always practiced that. We've heard of the adage, as above, so below. I would call it, as it is here, so everywhere, so that there is no linearity between above or left or right or any sort of lines anywhere. So for us, the earth has always not been square, flat, or ended at a particular point, but it has always been ovoid, like an ovum, like an egg, the things women carry and which create life. Furthermore, to challenge thinking a little bit more, I use this in my gender training with communities on the ground. When you draw a thing that looks like this, and I ask them, is this a penis, is it a vagina, what is it? You can't tell, because it depends on your perspective. And in transsexual surgery, when they make a penis, they construct a penis out of a vagina, and a vagina out of a penis, it's called inversion. So flip one's thinking a little bit. So when I'm talking about a gift economy, when I'm talking about feminism, when I'm talking about economics in general, when I'm talking about what does it mean to revere, to honor, to respect women, and to respect the sacredness of birth, and the fact that from our very bodies we have the power, nobody else has it, to create life. I do not hark to scholars elsewhere. I do not come to Barbara Mann's Iroquois and rape her people and her culture and her knowledge like others have done with our economies, and then stick it in a book as a chapter or pop it in my paper as a footnote. I do not go to Mali or Kenya without an invitation and posit people's ancient knowledge as my own. And a museum, a very famous example, the so-called Hottentot Venus, Sarah Bartman. Her remains remained in the Museum of Man in Paris for more than 100 years and was only repatriated to my country. Her bones were laid to rest in 2003. More than 100 years, her body was on exhibition and her tissue, her DNA, was used in European monster Frankenstein-like experiments. So when we talk about gifting, do we take the money that we've inherited from stealing other people's lands and dole it out like it's candy? Or do we gift from our souls? And do we gift ourselves with healing and love as much as we gift other people with the healing and the love that is within our souls and our hearts? If we are birthed and we have life that comes from the Creator as a gift, our very breath, inspire, is a gift. Do we go around and gift the world with that very inspiration, that deep, profound, there are no words to describe it, do we gift that to one another, to the world? Do we give life, breath, love in that way? Or do we go around and practicing the politics that we've been taught? That politics is not innate. Rape is not innate. beating and violence is not innate, it's not natural, no matter who says what. And if you want, we will invite you to our societies and our cultures so that we can teach you. When we come to these conferences, sometimes people treat it like a cocktail party. And I like cocktails. Margarita's my favorite, so don't misunderstand me. Betty Williams came to this conference, and she's Irish. I grew up Catholic. I'm no longer Catholic, obviously, because I practice my people's ways. Betty Williams created a gaffe, as some would say, some of us who were colonized by the English. She acted inappropriately, for which she's been apologizing ever since. And people are saying she came to a party on an invitation, and she should know better. She should behave. That's how some people construe a party, an invitation, a gathering. In my culture, I know some Jewish people have a bar mitzvah, which is the kind of coming of age ceremony. In my culture, from about the age of 13, boys and girls, no gender bias. When you're about age 13, you have a coming of age ceremony, and it's a huge party. Homeless people have been documented in my country throwing this huge coming of age party. Can you imagine a homeless person? No home, no clothes, no shoes. In the middle of winter, if your birthday and you're 13 in the middle of winter, people go and find things to create a huge feast, a huge ceremony. And it's not only the people I like Barbara and you, whom I invite. And it's not only the people I know who are in my street, on my street corner where I am homeless. It is everybody. And I share what little I have with everybody. And I don't police their behavior. I don't control their behavior. They can gaff as much as they like. You know? So this is an example of how differently, that's why I tried to talk about the what I was saying earlier. I'm trying to show a shift in thinking. We need to challenge ourselves when we're in the global north around how we taught and our thinking becomes so ingrained. It's like ossified, like bone or stone, that's it. But take a hammer and smash that damn thinking apart. So I take extreme umbrage and it breaks my heart when my culture is cannibalized and turned into a footnote or somebody's chapter in somebody's book. My culture has always practiced what some people call a gift economy. We have different names for it. We have always been matrilineal, and we will always be. We will continue to practice it. How much time? All right. See, indigenous people, we don't even take a lot of time. We're trained to be respectful. So if I could juxtapose two different thinkings and to be linear, if I must, which is not my favorite thing, if we think of logocentrism, and Jen mentioned earlier phallogocentrism, lovely word, we'll explain later what it means. If we think of Descartesian thinking, it posits that it goes like, I think, therefore I am. I think, my skull, my brain. Therefore I am. And we have an African term, which we're using across the continent Africa, because we're working on what we're calling an African Renaissance, for better or for worse, again, phallogocentric. But Ubuntu is the term the Pan-African movement is using at the moment. And it refers to I belong, therefore I am. So it's less I think, less I have, less I this and that, but I belong, therefore I am. My humanity is inextricably tied up with your humanity. When you are sad, I cannot be happy. If you are poor and starving, I cannot be feasting. When you are happy, you can't be happy while I am sad. Now that I am upset, we can't have a cocktail party unless whatever it is that I'm upset about has been resolved in my community, however my community is defined. And that fundamentally describes the ways in which our societies are very different. But I would argue that people descendant of Europe were like us as well. Their societies have just been pogromized, decimated, raped like ours later, and that you need to reclaim your own Ubuntu, not ours. You don't need to come to Mali for a gift economy. You need to look within yourselves, in your own neighborhoods, like some people are indeed doing. Reclaim your own power, your own strength, your own gifts, your own love. and the own sacredness of your bodies, feminine and masculine, or however defined. So, the sun is a kind of a star. And the sun exists to what end? What is the purpose of the sun? To make NASA rich? To take up tax money? To have people, to give us skin cancer? What's the purpose of the sun? The sun's entire existence, the sun exists to give light, to give life to people on Earth, to name one example. That's the sun gives. It is, by its very nature, a giver. It does not ask the moon, give back the reflection of light which creates your existence. It doesn't say to Earth, give me some cabbage because I made that cabbage through my light and my energy. It exists like every star, and as it's existing, it is dying. Its entire existence is grounded in its death, and it continues to give, just like woman, I suppose. If that is the sun, and that is the cosmos, and that is our nature, the green things, cabbage, the spinach, which I don't really like, the things I eat out of the earth, which I give thanks to before I eat it and after I eat it and as I eat it, these things, and we too are decomposing. As I'm standing here, I'm decomposing and I give. If this is our nature is not to accumulate, to be acquisitive, to be greedy, and to be resentful when we have to share what, you know, the abundance that there is. So if that is our very nature, we need to reclaim that nature. We need to remind ourselves daily of that nature. That is who we are. That is what we are. That is what the cosmos is. And no government, and no capitalist, and no European, and no anybody, no man can tell me that that isn't the truth. And my people, and every other indigenous people, including pagan Europe's, have always known that and have always practiced that without a fault. There is a native woman, and I think she might not be heterosexual, whatever that might mean. Her name is Christos. I learned about her when I went to a Woman in Black conference in Italy. I don't know where it is. She is a poet, and she writes with such grace and beauty. I knew nothing about this woman when I encountered the poetry by accident in some public library when I was growing up under apartheid. I discovered later that she's a native woman. She is a poet. In my culture and in where I come from, we treat our poets, our artists, we treat everybody with the utmost reverence and respect, because everybody creates, just like women create from our very wombs and our mere existences, we give life. This woman, Christos, is a domestic worker. She cleans other people's homes. And this is how this culture in North America treats its artists, treats its native people. She creates poems like we create life from our wombs. So I wanted to share with you her poem in closing. She says, this is a giveaway poem. I want to give you the first daffodil, opening from the earth I have sown, to give you warm loaves of bread baked in soft mounds like breasts. I have wrapped your face around me, a warm robe. I give you blankets, woven of flowers and roots. Come closer, I have more to give. This basket is very large. I have stitched it out of your kind words. This basket is only the beginning. Within this basket is something you have been looking for all of your life. Come, take it. Take as much as you want. I give you seeds of a new way. I give you the moon shining on a fire of singing women. I give you the sound of our feet dancing. I give you the sound of our thoughts flying. I give you the sound of peace moving into our faces and sitting down. Come, this is a giveaway poem. When my hands are empty, I will be full. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Just another reminder, if you have any questions, just pass them this way. And if you need another card to write your questions on, just put your hand up in the air. Okay, I'll come give it to you in a moment. Pass them, and then the first person in the row gets to have a brand new job collecting questions for us. Okay. So our next presenter, Marla, am I saying that right?
Mirla.
Mirla. Mirla, great. So Mirla Baldonado is an activist. She's an activist working to overcome the toxic environment and psychosocial effects of military presence in the Philippines. She is president of the Citizens Task Force for Bases Cleanup and the spokesperson for the Task Force on the Subic rape case. And she's here joining us from the Philippines. Please welcome Marla. Marla, can I ask you to use the microphone so that we can capture
Hello.
You?
I said magandang hapon po, and that means good afternoon in our language. Good afternoon, magandang hapon po. I'm here to talk about the changes which the theory of the gift economy brought to my 36 years of activism in the third world, specifically in the Philippines. I met the bringer of the gift economy in 1995, Genevieve Vaughn, without knowing beforehand who she was. I brought her to the refugee camp in a former Clark Air Force Base, where thousands of families who were victims of the volcano eruption were temporarily residing and where water was heavily contaminated. She felt very guilty about that. And it happens in other places like the U.S. The U.S. does not want to take responsibility, so she felt so much sympathy. And from then on, we started a friendship and a collaboration. There was something distinct about that friendship, because I gained something more than knowing about the world. It gave me the gift of feminism. Some of you might ask why I did not get that in the Philippines. First, because, as you see, I worked for 36 years in the movement, in the peace movement in the Philippines, and peace and nationalist movement. I was an activist since I was 18 years old during the time of the Vietnam War. When the U.S. bases in the Philippines were being used as important support base for that war, and aside from knowing that, we learned a lot from the U.S. There was a lot of impact on our movement by the U.S. movement. However, profound changes in my concept of leadership and method of leadership only came about in the last 12 years. I am now 54 years old, and I did qualify my activism as a third world activism for a purpose. It is definitely an alien world to many of you who live in the first world. For it is activism under heavily militarized conditions. It means running the risk of being abducted, disappeared, tortured, sexually abused, even raped, and put in prison and jail without the benefit of a fair trial. In the 1980s, while I was organizing base workers, urban poor, students to fight against the existence of the military bases, I was abducted by the Philippine military in a park outside of the naval base. I was kept, I wasn't surfaced for 2 weeks, meaning a candidate for extrajudicial killing, and I was taken to a field and a bungalow in a rural area where I was kept there for 2 weeks, and every other night I was being taken out of the house for blindfolded and being questioned about the movement that was going on and the organizing going on inside the military base. Fast forward, there was a strike 2 years after, so they wanted to extract information from me on who were the base workers who were actively working there. So we organized base workers and rural people and urban poor and students. And there, I was 30 years old then. And because I come from a middle class and a theater background, my understanding and commitment always grows in understanding, not from books, but from concrete experiences and practice. I'm saying this because this experience made me politically matured and provided me to get rid of the baggage of naivete. For 2 weeks, I stayed in a safe house, and they would pick me up every other night, blindfold me, and then water torture me, make me lie down in a narrow bench, tie my hands together, and then finally my family and friends and supporters were able to get the Philippine military to surface me. But it was a harrowing experience. And in that experience, I realized something very important. 3 months after I was put in a regular jail, a U.S. intelligence officer visited me and told me that from the moment of my arrest, the U.S. military was aware of that. And I noticed a different fashion of torturing me. The difference was that they were using U.S. military code names, and they were teaching people how to torture. So it was a harrowing experience. After my release, I continued the anti-basis movement, and in 1991, our efforts paid off. Through a strong movement, we were able to make our senators vote against a new treaty to continue the basis, not to continue the presence of the bases. So, I would, in the interest of time, is there time? Lots of time. So, I would like to end, probably conclude by saying that I got over my trauma of the harrowing experience because of the paradigm I had. I was working for systemic change. I searched my mind after listening to Professor Madikisela, if I could forgive my torturers. It didn't come across my mind because my framework was for systemic change. I saw it as an institutional violence. I wasn't looking at individual persons. I was even able to talk to my torturers while I was in prison, and I could laugh with them. I thought of it as changing a system. I was going for a systemic change. And I think I also need to say that it's not easy to become a feminist in the Philippines. I would not come up and say I'm a feminist, but I would debate and clarify even to men and women about my experience. I mean, about feminism, if there's a negative word about it. And so I would like to also say, in relation to the gift economy, that our vision was the same. We didn't want a society where only a few dominated and took benefit from. We wanted an egalitarian society. But I think the big addition of the gift economy to my experience in my association with Genevieve Vaughn was understanding patriarchy, because it's something that the Philippine movement also evaded. We were evading that because it was a male-dominated movement that didn't want to rock the boat and didn't want to give away the leadership to the women. So at that time that I met Genevieve Vaughn, I was resigning from that movement, and it was a good time because then I became free and independent to develop my leadership until we were able to go into even the United Nations level, get Princess Caroline to support this issue, write to President Bush and talk to the Philippine Senate, debate with the Department of Foreign Affairs Secretary, and in the year 2000 to get a delegation, combination of U.S. State Department, U.S. Department of Defense officers to stop their stonewalling and face these problems of people getting sick and dying in the former U.S. military bases. So I would like to end with some pictures of the continuing struggle of the Filipino nation against U.S. military presence. This is the most recent one. It's a huge demonstration before the handing down of a decision on the on a U.S. Marine who raped the Filipina. So I would just like to flash the images. So, I mean, the Philippines is like, it's not a priority. People don't see it as a problem anymore. So I just like to show the images to you to end. Yeah, oh, it's in flashing. I don't know why. The senator left. She was there. Yeah, that's the senator there. She supported this case. It's a landmark case. 15 years ago, you know, in the treaties and agreements with the U.S., there's always a vague and weak provision on trying U.S. military offenders. So it's a landmark case. We won against it, but still up for appeal. And then when the decision was to convict the U.S. Marine who raped the Filipino woman, in the dead of the night, they took back the U.S. Marine to the U.S. Embassy. So he's now under U.S. jurisdiction, and we still keep fighting, and we are questioning what they call the Visiting Forces Agreement. So with that, I would like to end. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Okay. Myrla, why don't you stay there? And I would like to ask all four panelists to stand in the front. And there's one question that's directly for Beverly, and it's just a logistical question. And the other questions you can decide amongst yourselves which you want to take. Beverly, the question for you is about the website. Somebody would like you to repeat the website and how to obtain a copy of the exquisitely beautiful quotes from your film. So pick up the microphone so that we can just please repeat the website
address.
Yes,
the website is otherworldsarepossible.org, and it's brand new, as is this collaborative, so there's not much content up there, and in a matter of days, this video will be up on YouTube, so you can get it there.
Okay, so hold on to that mic, Beverly, because we're going to
pass video,
it.
If you were to hit Gift Economy or Mali, you would find it.
Okay, hold on to that mic, Beverly, because you're going to pass it amongst yourselves. So this is a very interesting general question, and you can all take a shot at it. I just want to tell you that it's 3:30, so this is the official end of the session, and we all agreed that we were going to stay on for questions and answers. So this is for any of you to respond to. Is there such a thing as balanced capitalism? Could it be less, quote, evil if not patriarchal or corrupt? Or is capitalism inherently evil, using evil for the lack of a better word? So who would like to take a shot at that?
Well, before trying to answer that question, I'd just like to say it's the end of the first half of this session.
Right.
But the session will continue after the questions with more speakers about matriarchy as well as about the gift economy.
Thank you.
Does anybody want to answer the question on?
Anybody want to speak to capitalism?
Well, I can talk about it. Personally, I think the problem is the market. It's not just capitalism, it's the market itself. It's the interaction, the logic of exchange. So it's not only capitalism that's evil, it's the market. It's just that logic that takes us away from what we ought to be doing in directly satisfying needs and basing ourselves on a mothering way of doing things. However, there are places where women are in charge of the market, which maintain gift-giving values, because women use the buying and selling to create relationships, positive relationships with each other. And one example of this is the women in Juchitán in Mexico, and that has been studied, the market women of Juchitán, who are part of a matriarchal structure there. I do think that patriarchy and capitalism have merged. I appreciate the attempts to make a good capitalism. I think everything helps. However, I don't think that's the way we're going to get to peace generally and long term. It's a way of moving things over a way out, that are way out of balance, a bit towards the middle. But we need something completely different.